This is the BCA Podcast, the outreach arm of Beards Creek Adventures, and your weekly source for all things faith, family, and stewardship. We're your hosts, Charlie and Mike Culkin. Join us each week for interviews, discussions, laughs, and encouragement. We hope you guys enjoy the show. Welcome back to BCA Podcast, and tonight Charlie and I have a special guest, Travis Harmon, and he's the owner of Creative Habitat. We got connected with him a couple years ago just simply through ordering wildflower seeds, and we thought we were just adding some color and maybe helping out some of the pollinators, and the more that we have followed you, Travis, the more we realize this is a much bigger mission. And so tonight we're hoping to talk a little bit about that, and then specifically about bees. We've got some interest in bees. So welcome to the BCA Podcast.
Hey, I appreciate the invitation to come on and talk to your listeners. And those are all subjects that I'm excited about as well. So I'm excited to get into it and answer your guys' questions and see where I can help out, and maybe I can learn something from you. I follow your guys' content on social media, so I see what you got going on, and it's all good stuff, and just happy to take part in it.
Well, thanks. We aspire to have the media presence you have. I'm not sure anybody hustles more than you do in terms of Instagram stories. You're constantly on there.
Well, you know, there's a little secret to that as well, Mike. One thing about posting a lot of my content is it also is kind of a tracker for me that I can go back and look at posts and different content for timing of when I did things. I don't keep a real good logbook at times, and so I've definitely, it's like video documentation for me to be able to drop back and say, when did I do this? What did it look like? So I enjoy sharing it with people.
Yep.
But it's also a functional use for me I've found over time. It's not a total waste of time, I guess.
No, what a great idea. So, Travis, before we jump into that, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, how did Creative Habitat get started? Where are you located? Why wildflowers?
Sure.
That whole deal.
Yep. So, I started Creative Habitat 2016. By trade, I am in the CNC machining kind of manufacturing world. I've worked 25 years for a medical device manufacturer. I was in machining in the engineering department, project management. And, you know, I'm 45 years old now. A few years ago, I started thinking I would like to maybe retire a little bit early and have a legitimate business to go into myself.
Yep.
And so I thought, why not start something now and work into that? And maybe in 10 years or something, I'll have something that I can step away from the 9-to-5 grind.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up on a farm, always enjoyed gardening and growing things, the outdoors, hunting. That's my passion, I guess. I purchased a piece of property 17 years ago and 35 acres, doing the same thing you guys are doing. Mm-hmm. Wanted to transform that property for better hunting, better wildlife. And so started down that journey, planting food plots and, you know, wildflowers, native grasses, improving the timber stand, everything you guys are looking at. It's been an amazing journey. And, you know, after 7 or 8 years into the process, I'm growing these beautiful gardens. Mm. And I thought, you know, there's people that would probably want this. And so I decided to try it out as a business. Approached it first, mostly food plots and, you know, for hunting layouts and that kind of stuff. But people really love the flowers.
Yeah.
And so did a few high visibility jobs, really caught some attention. It's been a great experience so far, you know, doing this for customers and helping people develop their properties. I sold some seed, ended up developing a few wildflower mixes that I use in my projects. So I thought, why not offer those?
Yeah.
So we have a few mixes that we sell online. You guys have purchased and planted those. So just different revenue stream, and you know, it's been a great experience. I would have likely already, it's still my side gig. I still work full time at the regular job. I would have probably already exited and went on to this full time. But there's a situation that arose that I'm basically waiting on a severance package. And so the plant is closing down. We're going through that. I don't want to leave until, you know, I can get that 25-year severance or so. So I'm just kind of, you talk about working a lot and posting the content, definitely working a lot. Two jobs, very busy in the summer. I have to limit some capacity there for the business because of two jobs, but it's just been a great experience so far. I can't wait to go full-time on it. And the wildflowers now are about 60% of my business, I would say. I still do a lot of property, you know, work for hunting, food plots, wildlife development, those kind of things. That's about 40%. The flowers are really fun to grow. I mean, once you've mastered growing, you know, clover and your traditional food plot stuff, the flowers can be a real challenge. And if you enjoy growing stuff for wildlife, all the pollinator activity, you guys have seen it. In your flowers, I mean, it's just, it's really fun and beautiful as well.
It is so cool to walk out there and to see, you know, the timing of the different flowers at different points in the year. Yeah, the food plot's great, but the color and to see, you know, I'm using my Picture This app on every one of them and trying to, okay, do we have this on the list? Because, you know, in the varieties you provide the, you know, the flowers that come with them and, oh, California poppy, you know, or to see what's coming up. And it's a lot of fun to do it. So
That is one thing about the wildflower plantings when you really pack in a lot of variety. It is a constant show, changing show throughout the season and throughout the years. You know, the first year you're getting a lot of annuals, a lot of, you know, big bold color. The perennials are establishing down underneath those annuals. That second year, you know, you're moving into those perennials. Biennials are blooming. But plants don't, your flowers, the perennials don't really mature until that year three. And there's even varieties that I won't really see until year three at times, if you've kept the planting in good condition. Now, if you didn't do the first year justice, it can fall apart by year three, and you know, you're never going to see those plantings. Or if you have a lot of deer or some kind of other influence, you may not end up seeing those. But that's one thing that's enjoyable is the change in the planting. It's just fun to watch and all the activity. It's really enjoyable.
And that's one thing that I'm nervous about for ours is that it's in a, like in the springtime, it gets flooded, you know, under an inch or two of water. And, you know, I worry about what's it going to be, you know, year three kind of thing. We'll have to see, you know. We put in some drainage last year, which has helped. But we'll see what comes up, I guess.
That, you know, that's the way you got to approach a lot of this stuff is reacting through observation. You know, you're watching what happens with the planting, you know, different things moving into your planting, flooding like you're talking about. You just got to react to it appropriately when it happens, but be patient with the reaction. I think sometimes we want to react too quick and don't let nature do its thing. And so be patient with the response. But if it gets too bad, you can always start the process over again. There's nothing wrong with enjoying those first year annuals again, and just kickstarting it and resetting it and doing it all again. Once you've done it the first time and really broken the ground and done some things, it's a lot easier that second wave if you come back in 3 or 4 years later to replant it and kind of kickstart the cycle again. It's much easier to do than that first initial time you're coming in to establish something.
That's really interesting. So the first year that we planted, I didn't do any tilling. The area that we plant is along our food plot, which is a gas cut that goes through our property. And I just burned it down with Gly, and then, you know, basically seeded the matting. You know, we didn't have a tiller at the time. Yeah. And, you know, I've, since that first year, I've often thought, gosh, should I go back in, kill it again, and do it again? But I'm hesitant. And essentially, you've just said, well, if it doesn't go, then you know, don't be afraid to go in and do it again and prep it again. So that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. A fire is a great way to do a quick reset, you know, burn it, let it green up, let it get some, unless there's already enough material there that it'll burn early. You know, kill it, burn it off, and just reset it. You should know, normally with more mature plantings, by the middle of summer, you kind of know what condition that planting's in. If you got a lot of flowers, if you got things coming on, what varieties there. You can make a call then. I like to seed late in the season. June, July, don't mind seeding then at all. So I'll make the call on it then. If we need to flip it back, start bush hogging, killing, reseed it in the middle of summer, you've been able to enjoy some spring blooms on it.
Yep.
And then you're going to throw a fresh seed on it in the middle of the season, which a middle of summer seeding will create an amazing fall bloom. And in the fall, you've got the monarch migration going on. You know, a lot of plantings and a lot of flowers are on the downhill side. They're not blooming well. There's not a lot of stuff there. And if you got a planting that is peaking, you know, it's really peaking at that time, it'll draw a lot of attention from those monarchs and the hummingbirds at that time of year. I definitely witness an increase in activity for about 3 weeks. So I'm in northern Indiana, but you'll definitely notice it. And if you've got a peak bloom going on, the activity is even more fierce. So something definitely keep in mind. Don't be afraid to enjoy it in the spring, flip it in the middle of summer, put some seed on it, and enjoy a fall bloom as well.
Wow, what a great idea. Yeah, that's great information. What Charlie's looking at me like he's going to ask a question, but I'm going to ask mine first since I'm talking. So monarch, I always thought like the only thing they were after was milkweed.
No, definitely not. I would say milkweed is a host plant for monarch. That is where they're going to want to lay their eggs.
Okay.
And the larva, the caterpillar, feeds on the leaf of the milkweed. So it is definitely a critical plant for them.
Yeah.
But the butterflies want to feed on nectar and those kind of things. And when you've got these plantings that are just busting with color, I mean, you've seen it on social media. Your listeners can check it out.
Yep.
Absolute busting with color. There's a lot. It's like a food plot for nectar seeking animals. They just flock to it. And in the fall, when the numbers are up, when they're migrating and pushing through heavy, coming down from Michigan, Canada, you know, heading south, you're going to see a lot of activity. But I found, again, seeding in the summer is the key to getting strong activity, is having a peak bloom. Peak bloom period is usually somewhere around 12 to 16 weeks, you know, after your germination. That's when you're really going to start getting into a peak bloom, because varieties are going to spring early. You're going to have some later blooming varieties, but max color, you know, what's absolute max color is right there around that 16 weeks, something like that. And moisture plays a big part. If you have 3 or 4 weeks of dry period, it's going to stunt everything and slow everything down. And so moisture is a big thing. And it, you know, the past couple of years have been a struggle.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, man, just any growers, I just feel for everybody. I'm struggling with you guys. The weather and, you know, the dry periods and hot, it's just been terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible. But we managed a few great plantings during the past few years, so I can't complain a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, are there certain combinations of seedings or certain flowers that are able to handle those droughts better? If we're predicting that we're going to have another hot summer, are there things that we should be planting instead compared to what we would normally would?
Definitely, you know, your perennials can handle the drought conditions a lot better, the ones that have established roots, because the root systems go much deeper. But, you know, honestly, having an early planting that has a struggle, when I've seeded plantings and they really struggled the first 6 weeks or so, you know, to the point where I wasn't even sure if they were going to survive and I wasn't going to have to redo it. In those cases, those have produced some of the best plantings long term. It's like it benefits from the drier, rougher conditions, because great growing conditions also benefit weeds as well. Yeah. And the weeds grow much faster. You know, the problematic weeds, you know, we label them weeds. And I guess, you know, when you're coming into these plantings, you got to ask yourself, what is your goal?
Yeah. Right.
You know, are you trying to maximize color and eye appeal and attraction for pollinators, or are you just versatile wildlife type planting? A lot of what I'm doing, you're looking for eye appeal and those kind of things. So there is a difference in approach, but I think, you know, I like to throw a lot of variety at it. And if you throw a lot of variety at it, something's going to stick.
Yeah.
You know, something's going to benefit from those soil conditions and even the weather conditions. It's going to benefit better than a different variety. And if you've got enough in there of a little bit of everything, you're going to catch something.
Something's going to grow.
Yes, yes. If you're only throwing a few things at it, you know, you're at a higher risk for failure, I would say. Our lowest mix is like 24 varieties, and then the highest is up to 42. And I definitely put more than that on. So I do a lot of small batch seed mixes, so the varieties kind of bounce around a little bit. But I think key is really your mix of annual and perennial.
Yeah.
Because you're really using those annuals as a cover crop that first year. And, you know, those young perennials need some shade during that hot summer, those dry periods that we're talking about. And farmers use cover crops as well. It's the same concept. You probably do it with clover. It's common to use a cover crop when you're planting clover as well, trying to get it established.
Yep.
It's the same concept. So those annuals are there for that function. They're still going to volunteer seed and put some seed back into your planting. They fade out. They generally tend to fade out. But your soil conditions will impact what's going to happen there. You know, some soils seem to volunteer seed better than others. If it's a real hard pan, seeds on the surface might have trouble. But yeah, strong mix of annual and perennial and lots of variety, and you're going to get something to stick.
Well, let me ask you this then. If you've got a large variety that you're putting in and one or two of them take and you get some blooming from that, where's the line between it's failing or it's succeeding? If you've got a couple of them that are taking, at what point do you say we're going to restart to try and get more to take, or we're just going to leave the two that did take and let it go? Is there a line there?
I think back to your goals and what resources are available to you. Money's not an option. You can just continue to refresh it. I definitely have plantings that there's over once you get into that 3 and 4 year period, plantings really do settle into, you know, a half dozen or so varieties that are going to be stronger early spring. And then once those plants, and you guys, I'm sure, are starting to see this in some of your plantings, once the early bloomers kind of start to fade, there should be some other ones coming in behind them because it's their season.
Yeah.
You know, they favor those temperatures and they favor those lighting conditions and all that. So one common thing, I think I made the mistake early on, was I put my seed on too thick. And, you know, there's certain varieties I was talking about how they're going to like those soil conditions and those light conditions. They're going to be stronger. If you put your seed on too thick, chances are you got too many of those varieties per square foot and they're going to choke everything else out. Like almost immediately you'll end up with a monoculture because those strongest ones are just, there's too many of them and they'll fill in everything too quick. So I think, you know, don't go in too strong with your seeding out of the gate is important. Giving lots of room for things to spread out and, you know, not allow the aggressive ones to take over so quickly.
Yeah, that's so counterintuitive, right? Like
it is.
We just want to throw seed at it and think, oh, something's going to come up.
Yes, so. And that might be fine. You know, if you're fine with that, that's fine. But if you want maximum color variety And, you know, I find that plants that have lots of room to grow and show, it's prettier.
Yeah.
You know, you have these big like clouds of color and not just a single stem of color, you know, it creates a different type of eye appeal. And if you've prepared the seed bed appropriately, you can seed on a lighter rate.
Yeah.
Because you don't need as thick, because you don't have the weed competition and things if you've done the preparation.
Yeah. And your instructions that you send with the seed are fantastic. Like, it is straight, real clear. It's it's very easy to follow.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. You know, one thing about my normal career is I've taken a lot of what we use in medical device manufacturing. I'm a black belt now, which we just solve problems. Yep. Problem solving tools and statistical analysis and different things for manufacturing, and I'm rolling it over into growing flowers and using those tools. Clear work instructions is part of our deal, so it helped me write out a little bit.
Yeah. Right down to do a rain dance and wait.
Sure. You know, that water's critical, man.
Oh,
but
it is.
Don't be tempted. I find that, you know, it's not good to water them. In most cases, watering hasn't produced what I've been hoping it would do. It actually worked opposite for me and probably helped the weeds more.
Yeah.
You know, nature's doing its thing.
Yep.
And we as people and humans, we tend to rush things and want things in our timing and how we want it. And sometimes, you know, the creator created the perfect system and you just got to let it do its thing.
Yeah, that's a good word. That's a really good word. Because I'm that impatient guy. I'm trying to figure out how do I load up a 300-gallon tank and go water these things or something.
Yep. But
now I'm trying to convince my wife to get rid of the grass in our yard and just plant wildflowers. Like, I would much rather not have to mow and be able to just look at flowers out my back window. But she hasn't gotten on board yet. So
that's part of what got me started growing them at my place. Was there was way too much grass for me to want to mow. I started flipping it to food plots and flowers, and the more, you know, the flowers developed, the more grass I took out. That's one of my favorite cut type of projects, is a lawn grass transition from something that was being maintained and mowed to wildflowers, because honestly, grass is just useless for anything but keeping dirt from getting on your shoes, and we're wasting a lot of resources. We all know, you know, the jive around climate change and all that jazz, and I believe there's something to it, and that, you know, we're spending a lot of unnecessary resources and time when flowers can look a lot better. But I agree. Flowers, traditionally, what we've seen is it's just a bunch of weeds. My customers are concerned. You know, a lot of new customers are concerned about that. But until they see it, you know, what can be, then they believe it.
Wow. So we, before we jump into beekeeping, which is really what we were hoping to talk about, I had two other questions or thoughts for you. One is, so why should a hunter care about the wildflower stuff, you know, pollinators? Why is that important for us, as turkey hunters, as deer hunters or grouse hunters? Why should we care, you know, about?
Sure. Now, I'm with you 100%. If your objective is deer and those kind of things, you're thinking traditional food plots, clover and those kind of things. That's where my mind was at as well at one time. But the deer really like a lot of these flowers.
Yeah.
We should not dismiss them as a food source, summer food source for these deer, as well as the birds.
Yeah.
A lot of turkey activity. You know, I have birds myself. I have peacocks, I have chickens. Where do they like to be? They will be in the wildflowers, because there's a lot of insects in there.
Yeah.
And poults and young turkeys, you'll see a lot of activities in those wildflowers, and that's the reason, because there's a food source there for them. You know, the pollinator benefits and all that. So definitely don't dismiss it as an attraction.
Sure.
For wildlife as well. But there's also always those out-of-the-way places, you know, that aren't really suited for a food plot, those kind of things. And, you know, once you've got your plots established and those kind of things, and you start looking at those other areas of how can I improve this spot, you know, it might be a corner area. It doesn't have to be a big area to really make an impact and look nice.
Yeah.
So those small locations, I would consider that. You know, sometimes if there's not wildflowers there, there's not some kind of quality habitat there in that spot, what else is going to be there benefiting you and the wildlife on your property? You know, tackle those food plots first, get that management plan in place with your bedding and your sanctuary. But then once you're past that, you start looking at what else can I do? Wildflowers is a great consideration, as well as the honeybees, yeah. You know, what we plan to talk about. I consider that, and from my point of view, it's kind of like when you get your plots in and what your objective is, you bought your property for hunting. Once you got that set up, then you want to start monkeying around with other stuff.
Sure.
And so bees are a great way to bring some value back to you through honey harvest at the end of season. Mm-hmm. As well as it's fun, they're cool to watch, you know, just their process, and you don't have to make it any harder than you need to.
Yeah.
You can dive deep into it. You can, you know, stay back and be more of a naturalist. But there's a lot of benefits to having those quality pollinator plantings. Yeah. And, not to mention the benefit of pulling other people into it. If you've got, you know, kids, your wife, your girlfriend, mm-hmm. I don't know a female that doesn't like flowers. And I'm telling you, man, you can pick some really nice bouquets out of these wildflower plantings. I know you've seen it on my page. Yep. I plant these flowers for several U-Pick farms, for wedding venue photographers. I mean, they're beautiful, and it gives an activity for the family. They love watching the butterflies and things in them. So a lot of benefits there.
Yeah. I have not been able to bring myself to pick any of our flowers. I mean, we have plenty of them. I just can't, I just like them. I love
sure.
them. To be able to be out there walking around and seeing them. And I probably should, my wife would probably appreciate it, or Charlie's girlfriend would appreciate it, but
I can almost guarantee you, boys, you take that first bouquet, you'll be back for more.
So the other question, and then we'll jump into the bee stuff, is, and we were talking about this even off air, is the idea of natives. Are your seeds all native wildflowers?
So the four mixes that I offer online are not native blends. Hmm. There's definitely some non-natives in there, not invasives.
Yep.
Nothing, you know, nothing invasive, but there's definitely some non-natives in there, mostly around the annuals.
Okay.
And I like the annuals that are in our mixes because they provide that shade. They're fast germinating, produce a lot of nice color. They're really cut flower quality
yeah.
annuals. You know, and that's part of what makes them really beautiful. But do a nice function, and definitely have not seen issues with, you know, that second and third year and just rampant spreading of the flowers. But in reality, Mike, there is natives in my mixes that I have seen spread very strongly.
Really?
You know, a lot of times the soil condition, what the soil is, the condition, and also what it's competing with can impact, you know, its invasive tendencies.
Yeah.
And so Dame's Rocket is a great example.
Yeah.
labeled invasive here. Absolutely labeled invasive. It's not in my seed mixes. It shows up in a good majority of the plantings that I do because the seed's just there mm-hmm. in the soil. But a lot of times I'll let it go. It produces a really nice spring flower.
Yep.
But as long as you have other varieties there that are competitive at the period at which that plant is growing, It'll keep it in check. It'll keep it in check. But if it doesn't have that competition, there's not a good combination there, you know, then you can have issues. But so I'm not a very big, you know, critic or whatever on native versus non-native. My mixes that I offer online definitely have non-natives in there.
Sure.
But I do native plantings for customers. I don't have an issue with people that want to stay native. I actually own a WRP property where we have to plant all natives on that. So I support that 100%.
Yeah.
So I just mix up custom mixes in those cases. I definitely do that for people upon request. I sell seed on a custom mix basis as well. That's one of the benefits of being small.
Yep.
Is that I can still do that kind of stuff for people. So, but yeah, that's kind of where I stand on the native and non-native. And I understand everybody's got their position and opinion on it, and I'll support however people feel about it.
You know the thing about opinions, right?
Absolutely.
So it's funny you mentioned Dane's Rocket, because we have that, and in places where we've done some heavy TSI work, it pops up and it's beautiful. But you're right, where we've been planning the mixes, it's kept that in check. You know, it really has held that back. That's interesting that you say that. So, all right. So Charlie was the one who said, "Hey Dad, we got to do some bees. We need to look at doing bees." So, take us into a little bit of that. Like, how did you get involved with it? How difficult is it for two knuckleheads like us? what does it take to keep bees?
Sure. You know, really what got me started in it is I had customers that had bees.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, I really need to learn something about this because if my customers are going to be into it. So I decided to dive into it. A recommendation I would have for anybody that is going to get into beekeeping, there's nothing wrong with seeking out a mentor. You know, somebody that is familiar with keeping bees and, you know, just picking their brain, befriending them. I had a guy that was a friend.
Wait a minute. Did you really say that?
Did you do that on purpose?
What? Befriend?
Befriend.
Oh, what a pun. Nice, man. Well done.
Oy.
But yeah, it's perfect. I had a friend of the family. He had some honeybees. I had an opportunity to purchase a hive that had some bees in it. I didn't really know much about it, but I knew he had bees, so I got a hold of him, got the hive to my house. I said, "Hey, I'll tell you what, the hive's sitting here, it's got bees in it. You come and harvest the honey, you can keep half of it, and I'll just, you know, kind of talk to you about the process and whatever." And so he came down, you know, and harvested the honey. I got to watch the process. You know, my customers had talked about bees. And one thing about bee people, and I would say bee fanatics, they can talk bees for a long time. So my customers, some of them really filled my ears up with different bee strategies. And that is one thing about beekeeping. And it's the same as deer hunting strategies. And there's different camps, you know, and people enjoy doing things different ways. And so there's people that really like to get involved with the hives and, you know, get in there and look at brood and make sure the queen's fine and laying eggs. And, you know, they might be treating for certain pests at various times of the year. And so that's one camp I've found. And then there's another camp that's more of a naturalist, I would call that, is where they're not really getting in the hives as much. They like to have the hives on the property. They like to watch the bees. They like to partake in, you know, consuming the honey. Mm-hmm. But they don't necessarily want to use chemicals to treat for pests. They don't want to get in the hive once a month to do inspections. And that's really the camp that I am in.
Yeah.
I'm up to 4 hives now. All my bees that I have now have been wild caught. I've baited them into the hives during swarming season, which is in the spring. It's coming on here real soon. So it's a great time to talk about that subject. It's a cheap, easy way to get into having some bees, is catching some local bees that are already in your area. I've also purchased nukes. You can buy swarms. Okay. Sometimes you got to pre-order them or whatever, but I guarantee you somebody in your area is offering bee swarms so you can buy some. You know, I bought farm swarms is what I call them, and I ended up losing those. They died in the winter. I didn't treat them. And, you know, I think that's part of the two camps is, you know, the pest control. There's the varroa mites, which are a real bad pest, kills the bees, makes them weak. And in the winter, a lot of times you'll lose your swarms. They'll die because of the mites and the pests.
Interesting.
So I found that those ones that are in the wild tend to have, call it natural selection or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, they're surviving without chemical treatments and all that. So those are the bees that I want. Or somebody that has strong genetics who may not have been treating with chemicals, and you know the bees are just naturally fighting off the pests. Yeah. That's part of nature, you know, is yep. natural selection and pests and those kind of things. And I do think some bees have a better resistance to it naturally. And so I would encourage anybody who's looking to get bees is to first try to catch some local to your area or hook up with somebody that has, you know, a strong genetic, you know, kind of strain of bees. Maybe you can still order online and do those kind of things, but I think you're going to have better results if you try to go local and catch some, you know, some wild bees.
Sure. So
now there's
So there's two questions. When you say you're up to four hives,
yep.
is that so? When we see the standard beehive boxes, is that does each drawer looking thing of that, does that count as a hive, or is it each separate box, like four different box sets? Is that a hive?
Normally, you know, let's call it a skyscraper or a tower.
Okay.
The stack of boxes is considered the hive in total.
Okay.
On the bottom, you'll have a couple of larger boxes. You can see they're a little thicker, you know, they're a little bigger usually. Yep. Those are your brood boxes. Those are where the bees are laying eggs and raising young larvae and all that stuff. There'll be some honey and stuff kept there, nectar and pollen to, you know, feed the upcoming bees and those kind of things. That's where that activity takes place. Mm. A lot of times the hives will start off short mm-hmm. with maybe just one brood box and maybe one honey box. And some people like to see the bees fill all the frames that are in those boxes and comb them all out and get them completely full before they're adding, or almost full before they're adding on those additional, you know, extra tower stacks. Those are called your supers that are on top, your honey supers.
Okay.
And, you know, you start getting into it, you're going to have to learn that bee lingo now. You know, you're talking those honey supers. You know, and hives can, you can make them as tall as you want. Let me tell you, when one of those 10 frame boxes is full of honey and you're pulling it off at, you know, chest high and up to your head, they're heavy.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
hives are heavy. Lot of weight to that honey. So I recommend shorter hives.
Okay.
But yeah, that's kind of the structure.
Okay.
The brood at the bottom, a lot of bees at the bottom. That's where your reproduction's happening. And the honey storage is up on top. And, you know, you want to leave the bees some honey for winter.
Yep.
And that's all up to, you know, there's a lot of opinions on how much you should leave and all that. Everybody's got their own idea on that.
So then there's one queen per hive, correct?
Yep, one queen. She, you know, can live for years. Anything can happen, I suppose. If the queen dies, the bees will, like, immediately recognize that the queen is no longer there through pheromones mm-hmm. and stuff. You know, it's really, really intricate and neat how a bee colony functions. And the bees move up through responsibility in the colony of cleaning when they're young. They're just like, you know, nurse bees maybe. And then they move in rank as they mature, and then they're out foraging. And it's just really detailed if you want to get that far into it, I guess. But yeah, if the bees sense that the queen is no longer there, they will take an existing egg that that queen had laid, and they might take several of those eggs, and they start feeding them, and get ready for this, another one of those terms, royal jelly. They start feeding them the royal jelly, and it will turn those eggs into a queen bee.
Wow.
And yes, and if they don't feed it the royal jelly, it'll just turn into a regular bee. But once they start producing the queen cell, we'll call it, it's a special, you know, pocket or whatever, what have you. And then that's where that egg will be. The queen will develop in there. Sometimes you get multiple queens hatch at once. And then I believe, you know, the first queen that hatches, it's kind of like the Game of Thrones. you know, they can kill each other. They can kill them before they emerge, you know, but she knows what she's got to do. And then there's the breeding flight. And so this is another wild thing about them. The queen needs to be mated. And she only needs to be mated once, I believe. But the drone bees, the guys in a bee colony, they don't work, my understanding. All they do, they're only there to do this one-time thing.
Yep.
And that's, you know, like breed the queen on a breeding flight. They'll leave the hive, fly off, do that thing in the air, and then they'll come back to the hive. The queen is now bred, and she can lay fertilized eggs. And so the new queen, if she emerges, has to be bred. And so a queenless hive will go through a period where it's not producing new bees, and, you know, it makes it weak. And so it'll take it a while to kind of get back on its feet. And a lot of times, sometimes you need to be more restrictive of harvesting honey out of those hives. You know, you got to give, don't rob the bees too bad.
So let me ask you, you mentioned collecting bees like wild and baiting them in. What are you using to bait them in? And B, if you're baiting them in, how are you specifically trying to get a queen bee? If you bait them in, will they turn one of them into a queen bee? How does that work? Or do you still have to go out and get a queen bee?
So bees will swarm when the hive gets too full. And so, you know, and it just doesn't just happen in hives. If there's a natural, you know, beehive in a tree or in the ground somewhere or whatever, when it runs out of room and there's too many bees, they kind of know they need to split off and it's too full here. And so, you know, they may produce some queens, or an old queen gets kicked out and a portion of the bees will go with her. And they're on a search for a new home. And so that's one way to catch a swarm. Is a lot of times, you know, they'll exit the current, you know, comb, the current hive or wherever they're staying, and they'll hang in a tree, or, you know, they'll be out exposed. There might be thousands. It could be as small as just a handful. But there's a queen in there, and the scout bees are out looking for a new home. And so they're out, and they may already have identified it before they even left the hive that they're in. But once a suitable home is found, the scout bees come back, now get this, and they do a special dance in front of the, it's weird, do a special dance in front of all the other bees. It gets them all excited, and then they all zoom off to the new home. And, you know, that's my favorite way to catch them, because if you come in and try to catch the swarm when it's hanging on a branch or whatever, you can definitely do that. People do it all the time. Shake it down into a box or, you know, some frames or one of those, you know, bee boxes with frames in it. Get that queen in there and all the bees are going to follow her. They can smell the pheromone. They know where she's at. And so they're going to follow her right into your container or however you're trying to catch them. So that's one way. And then you got to transport them back to a permanent home. What I like to do is to set up a hive and have it all set up and ready to go for them. And, you know, there's attractants that you can buy online. I'll caution you, that's the same as deer scents and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anytime somebody can sell some snake oil, they will. And so, you know, there's a lot of different swarm baits and things you can put inside of that hive. A lot of them are like lemongrass oil based because there's a pheromone that's emitted when those bees have found a home, I believe, and the lemongrass oil is close to that type of scent. And so, you know, that can help draw them into it. You can put some honey in there, you know, to make it attractive to them. But one thing I've definitely found is if you have one of these wildflower plantings or a really nice clover plot that's in bloom, yep, or several apple trees that's attracting a lot of bee attention, you know, and the higher quality planting, the more attention it is attracting, you'll get a lot of bee activity there. And those are great places to catch a swarm because the bees are already frequenting that spot on feeding and foraging. They find your hive is there and they think, dang, you know, here's this nice place. It's got combed out frames. So that's one thing I think that's important if you're trying to catch a swarm is to have a couple of frames in that hive at minimum that are fully built out with comb. You know, they're used frames, basically.
Yeah.
Move-in ready condition. And so, you know, that's real attractive to them, I think. It's kind of ready to go, start laying eggs immediately. If they have to build out the comb, you know, the infrastructure, that takes a lot of energy, a lot of resources, and, you know, they're not going to do as well. So I think having, you know, built out used frames in there is real critical. Dump a little honey in there. Set the hive up close to a nice food source, like I was talking about, clover or wildflower patch or something like that, and then let it roll. You know, you set it there, you check it frequently just to see if there's activity. Sometimes I've caught them that way as quick as 2 to 4 days.
Wow.
I mean, now there's chances are you may get activity there of what's called robber bees. They're just coming in there to feed and to take honey out of that hive and, you know, basically rob it of its resources. Sometimes you'll get some of that activity, but you will know it when a swarm moves in because there will be a lot of bees coming in and out of it. Totally different type of activity. I've had a lot of luck with doing that. And
well, we've got a lot of clover, and we've got, you know, and it runs right along our wildflower planting, and
that is a fantastic spot to set up a hive.
So would the hive, do you orient it a certain way? Like, is it okay on the edge of the woods, or does it need to be out towards the middle? Does it need to be facing, you know, away from the predominant winds or away from sun or anything like that?
I think you definitely do want to consider, you know, the elements. I've definitely got them in varying spots. Some of them are out, you know, no shade. Mm-hmm. Other ones are in shade, more protected areas. You know, you guys are up in New York. Winter kill is a big deal.
Yeah.
Really, you should, I think even, you know, the statistic or whatever the percent is, you should expect about a 30% loss. So that's why having just one hive, I don't know if it's a good idea. I think having more than three is a good idea, because if you lose your one hive, you're out. You know, and if you think about that 30% mark, if you've got three and you might lose one, you still got two that can replenish that. A great spot to catch them is right next to another hive. You know, there's already bees there and all that. And so a lot of times I'll set up a hive next to a previous hive, try to catch them that way. But definitely think about the elements, putting them in the shade, nothing wrong with that, where they might get some morning sun to warm that hive up quick, you know, and get that activity going. Then that hot afternoon shade, you'll see the bees coming out of the hive in the heat of day. They'll ball up on the outside to regulate the temperature on the inside. If they sense it's getting too hot, a lot of bees will move outside of the hive. I mean, it's really they got a whole system going on, but the winter is a concern, and wind blockage. So we all know, sitting out in a tree stand, wind chill, the wind will kill you.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so, you know, having a good windbreak, I think, is critical in the north. You can put protection on the hive in the winter. It's kind of up to you how you want to handle it. Luckily, that's one thing about this whole warming trend we got going on. Our winters have not been as bad. We definitely have some bad shots.
Yep.
You know, and I've lost some hives over the past couple of years, but this past winter, can't really complain. I didn't lose any hives this past winter, so
yeah. It's not sustained cold. That. You know, sustained cold or snow depth, and yeah, yep.
Yep. So yeah, I definitely encourage you guys, give it a try. Now, you always got a backup of purchasing a swarm. So I found great deals on hives on Marketplace, you know, just look. Sometimes you got to be patient, because believe me, there's people like me out there trying to scoop them up. So sometimes you got to find a deal and be patient. But if you find a used hive, I wouldn't be afraid to buy it. Yep. Go ahead, give a try at catching a swarm. Now, there's a few different sayings, you know, something about, you know, catch a swarm in May, it's going to make hay. Catch a swarm in July, it ain't worth a fly. Because the bees need to have time to build resources, you know, and get ready for winter. And so I think the earlier you can catch and get bees in your hive, making a home of it, the better you're going to be.
Yeah.
So what I recommend to a lot of my customers and people is, let's try to catch them first, get the hive in place, let's get it baited. You can watch it play out through June-ish, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. something like that. But have a plan B if you really want to make sure you have bees, and have somebody lined up or know where you can get some bees.
Yeah.
And then if you haven't caught any, because sometimes you don't catch. And if you haven't caught anything, then you can always go buy some bees, throw a swarm in there, and you're off to the races.
Wow. Now, do you have now, to... I was going to say, do you have to, do you got to buy like the bee suit and the smoker and everything else?
You definitely, you know, have an equipment. You'll see people on social media handling bees with no, you know, protection and things. I'm not really like that. I don't like getting stung.
No, me either.
So I suit up completely. I've never gotten stung, not once.
Wow.
I harvest my own honey. I've moved bees for people. With proper, you know, kind of suiting up and precaution, it's completely safe.
Yeah.
I ain't got nothing to prove on that. but that is one of the benefits, I think. If you get hooked up with a mentor, you don't necessarily have to make that investment right out of the gate.
Sure.
My first year, I didn't go out and buy that equipment. I didn't need to, and I had bees on my place, you know, but it was just the neighbor that we knew taking care of them, and I was just observing. So it's definitely an investment there for the suit and things. You can find deals on used suits,
mm-hmm.
honey extractors, or you can find deals on that stuff. I built my Armada on a lot of used equipment. And the honey extraction, you know, it's some work. I think last year we might have pulled 130 pounds of honey or something like that. You know, and I spun that all myself and harvested it myself. It's satisfying at the end. But that 4 or 5 days, you know, it's a lot of effort and work to do that, but super satisfying. You get to share those rewards with your family, friends. It'll last you the full season into that next year. It's good stuff.
Yeah, we do the same with maple syrup.
Yeah.
And, oh, cool. Yeah. Absolutely. So you get it. Yeah, you get it.
Yep.
I got a question. So here's combining our flowers and our bees. Have you found any kind of difference in flavors in your honey depending on what flowers are planted?
So you definitely a difference in honey. Even out of the same hive, same bees, from year to year, I've seen differences. I think it definitely does impact, you know, it definitely does. Everybody's going to tell you that about what's available will change the flavor. But I think, you know, some bees probably produce, I've got some hives, man, that produced some awesome honey last year. I mean, it was some of the best stuff I've ever tasted. Creamy, so good. I hope they do it again this year, because that stuff was fantastic. You know, and the harvesting at a certain time of year, clover honey will be real light colored. You know, and that, at the period of the time of year that you harvest, I think makes a difference. If you get in there and you harvest your honey early before like goldenrod and thing like that, stuff like that's come on late in the year. But you've also got different layers in that hive. You know, you got honey at the bottom all the way to the top. And if you've added boxes throughout the season, those boxes, you know, are going to have some different seasonal varieties in there. So I think you can get different honey out of the same box, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But when you're extracting it and you're going through all that work, you're probably not going to put forth the effort to try to separate all that stuff. You just, I like to keep my hives separate for sure. Yeah. That way I'd say this honey came from this hive, and compare the three and kind of rate them and know which ones I'm going to give my family, which ones I'm going to give
them. We do the same with syrup.
Sure. Yeah.
Wow. It's so fascinating. We just have not had a whole lot of, interaction with the bee world, other than the movie. And, and it's fascinating. They really,
it is unbelievable.
You could lose an awful lot of time in watching them and, you know, tracking all this stuff. Like I could see where this could really become a fascinating hobby.
Yeah, I'm already on Marketplace during the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are people that are absolutely ate up with it. And it is fascinating. It's cool to watch. They're out there doing it.
Yeah.
The bees are doing it. We might not have been paying attention, but they're out there doing it. And when you're getting involved, I think you're providing a home for them.
Yeah.
You're watching that activity, and then you're getting that reward at the end of the year. Yeah. It's super cool. I think you guys will like it. But like I said, I don't spend a lot of time on it throughout the growing season, throughout the summer. There's an intense period of activity there in the fall where I'm harvesting honey and those kind of things. If I lose a hive and it dies in the winter, I can always use that hive as a swarm bait the next spring. So no big deal to me, you know, and it's a good time. Yeah.
What time of fall do you normally harvest? Because I'm just trying to think. That's kind of our busy season.
Yeah, so I think you can, one thing, wind chill, it's kind of back to that for me, and there's probably a lot of different opinions on this, depending on who you ask. Wind chill is a factor in the winter, so I want to give the bees enough time to seal the hive back up. They will seal those cracks, you know, with polypropolis, I think they call it, or something like that. Probably said it wrong, but they'll fill those cracks and those crevices, and that way it's sealed up. If you break that too late, they don't have time to seal that up. And if you break it too early and we get cold spells and things, you know, create wind chill inside the hives. So I like to harvest early enough that they got time to get that done. You want your honey to be workable. Cold honey is just like cold syrup, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So warm temperatures definitely help with your harvesting process. So I'm usually, you know, right there, August, September, you know, I'm kind of thinking about getting in there. I like to leave plenty for the bees.
Sure.
And so, you know, I give them enough time. There's still goldenrod happening and things going on that they can replenish some of what I've stolen. But people harvest in the spring as well. They'll harvest in the front of season and really harvest. And the bees got lots of time to build reserves back up.
Right.
And, you know, they might avoid some of the plants or pollen or nectar that they don't want in their honey that way. I don't think there's any wrong answer. That's one of the fun things about it. And it's same with growing the flowers and doing habitat management. You're taking part in it and you're enjoying it. There's no wrong answer. You know, you're not doing anything wrong, I don't think.
No. If for us, you know, our motto is faith, family, and stewardship. And part of stewardship of the land is realizing, you know, there are things besides a deer that you can take off the land, right? And so the maple syrup and, you know, we do some gardening and we do chickens and the idea of doing bees and selling wood for timber sales, but also firewood. I'm starting to make myself out to be a homesteader, but it's
absolutely.
But there is, I mean, if you treat the land well, it and the environment well, or the resources well, I guess is the way to say it. Then it can be a win-win. It can give back to you, and I think this is just another way of doing that. And
yeah.
I mean, all of these crops need pollinators, right? I mean, all of these ag fields around us, our food plots, all of the, somehow it's all connected. It needs those pollinators. And you know, in return to be able to harvest honey would be fabulous.
Yeah.
So,
And I definitely noticed an increase in my apple tree production. I brought bees onto the property. after I had mature apple trees and fruit trees and all the garden stuff, and definitely an increase after I had bees right there. There's a ton of pollinator activity. You got those bees, but bees will also travel 3 miles to feed.
Interesting.
So, you know, they will travel a long ways, but I think the more efficient they can be with great food sources close, the more productive the hive can be because they're more efficient at foraging and bringing it back to their stores.
Yeah, I had one of my questions to ask was, you know, if we were to set up bees within 50 yards of our flowers, is that too far? But 3 miles is pretty significant. Yeah.
Now, you will see bees flying right past your flowers, just hauling, heading somewhere, you know, to wherever a good food source is. And you're thinking, why aren't you just going right here?
Wow.
And you'll find there are preferred flowers that they're looking for and certain seasonal things, and they know what they're doing. So just let them do their thing, I guess.
And so those are all going to probably be part of the mixes, I'm sure, if we let them come up. There's something in there that they're going to hit on.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely some some desired varieties in there. Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
Wow.
So, boy, we've kept you about an hour, which is what I think I said. I would keep you an hour or so. And so I want to honor your time. But I do have one more big-time question, and then I'm going to have you kind of give us information where to find you.
Yep.
So have you done any tip layering?
Oh, the old tip layering. You know, it still blows me away a little bit that that's what it is called.
It
makes no sense.
I've never heard it called that. I don't know. Yeah. John's from a different part of the state, so I've never heard it called that.
Well, down here in Indiana, we think all you New Yorkers are kind of odd. Whatever it works. I've seen it online. I don't even know what they called it on the videos I saw it in. Definitely works for my raspberries.
Yep, exactly.
And you guys know it. When you've got property, it's a great way, propagation, to expand what you've got to work with without drawing a lot of resources out of your bank account. So definitely all the tricks work.
Yeah.
And if you're just patient, that's another thing, patience, you know, letting nature do its thing. Yep.
Yeah. Just to be clear, we're 8 hours from New York City. So don't, you know, and we're, oh, and we're 3 hours from
there. Huh?
We're about 3 hours from Syracuse. So, we're as far west in New York, just about as you can get. So we identify closer with Indiana than we do with New York City.
I consider us Midwesterns.
Midwestern. Wow.
Yeah. Yep.
That's funny.
Wow. All right. So, Travis, where can people find you? Where can they, get in touch with you?
So, we do have a website, creativehabitatllc.com. You can order seeds there, check out links to different, you know, stuff that we offer. Social media accounts. We are on Facebook and Instagram. I don't really update Facebook a lot. I more post our current content on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So you can check out what we got going on there, some of our past stuff, a lot of exciting projects this year. So be happy to have you follow along.
Yeah. And always, always great music choices too with your stories.
Hey, we're all artists, aren't we? And so if the content's not going to be good, at least the music can be.
That's right.
So that was kind of my approach on that. Wow. But yeah, check us out there. We offer seed sales, consultations, projects, you know, sky's the limit.
Mm, great, great. Well, I will. I'll make sure those are posted in the podcast, and when that comes out, that link will all be there. And man, I am so glad we were able to make this work. I know this is your busy season or coming into your busy season, but this was hugely helpful and encouraging to us in terms of both what we're doing with wildflowers, but also what we're looking at doing with bees. So,
cool, man. I'm glad I could help out. Yep, definitely busy season. Wouldn't mind swinging back around with you guys again later on.
All right.
So just let me know.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yep. All right. We'll see you guys later. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Yep. Thanks, Travis.
All right. Bye.
Bye.